Jerry Bader Show, 10:35, couple 4 inches of snow for good chunks of Wisconsin today. Oh, yeah, there it is. There's that Budweiser ad. My wife played it for me last night. People absolutely are going nuts over this one. Jason, have you seen it? The little, I think it's a golden lab puppy and the horse, the Clydesdale. It is. It's called Puppy Love. It's, you know, I would think most people would consider this a chick flick in a spot. But unless you have a heart of stone, even any guy should love this thing. Puppies in this little puppy adoption thing gets under the fence. By the way, there is no dialogue with this, Jason, so you're not missing anything as Jason watches it. Then the puppy is taken away in a car, and the horse takes off after it. This one is really cool. And then three or four horses block the front, and then the Clydesdales walk the puppy back. And the puppy does a little puppy dance, and then it's with the horse. Yes, yeah. Warm Springs Puppy Adoption is the place that it escapes from, and ultimately they're going to take it away because it keeps wanting to go and be with the horse. Puppy Love. See? Couple of men. You really like that, don't you? Now, I want you to... People love those Budweiser spots, right? Does anyone ever notice they have nothing to do with beer? Nothing. I have argued for years that emotional appeal is how you advertise. You don't advertise. And by the way, I learned this from one of the greats in the industry, Nick Michaels. He is a genius. He blushes when you tell him that, but he is a genius. You look at that and wonder, well, why would you do that to sell beer? All right, at some point, if you drink commercial beer, you're going to have an emotion attached to your selection. And that look at the emotion that they create there. It's just, it's, if you haven't seen it, you can find it anywhere online. It's really good. I do find, here's another thing. I find it interesting the way they're releasing these now in advance of the Super Bowl. They started that in the last couple of years, which seems to defeat almost the whole purpose. Now, what is left, though, is for you to wonder, well, what aren't they showing me? If they're giving that up now, what's the really cool thing they have? And that is the way they've been doing it. Then they have one on Super Sunday that's, aha. Because this one is really, really very good. Again, if you Google Budweiser Puppy Love, you'll find it. You'll find it almost instantly. But it is it's an emotional appeal. Here's one for you. Which slogan has the greatest emotional appeal of almost any product out there? What is a slogan that tries to sell its product with emotion and I think is very effective, where this warm fuzzy, there's a product that has a very brief slogan. I'll give you the biggest clue in the world, Jason, and then you should get this in 5 seconds. After I give you this clue, you should get this slogan in 5 seconds. It has nothing to do with color and clarity. I bet you people are screaming at their radios right now that they know the product to which I'm referring. There is a product that uses what I think is one of the best emotional appeal slogans out there. Just put the phone down for a second. That's fine. It's not working anyway. Put the phone down. Here. So what's your guess? This slogan has nothing to do with cut, color, and clarity. What does cut, color, and clarity tend to describe? What item? What item? No, let me throw in carrot. Carrot, cut, color, clarity. Diamond. Okay, now think diamonds. Who sells diamonds with the best emotional appeal in the world? Every kiss begins with K. Absolutely. That has nothing to do with the diamond and everything to do with what you expect that diamond to do for you if you're a guy. That's exactly right. Puppies have nothing to do with beer. I bet they sell lots of beer. All right. Dan Henninger, today's Wall Street Journal, his Wonderland column. Obama's State of Disunion. His operating method has been social and political division. The 2000, and by the way, this is what he's talking about. We all know that Obama has been a divider. Henninger does a great job of pointing out that this is so in his DNA that this has been his MO in everything that he's done. Here it is. The 2008 campaign phrase, hope and change, will haunt future histories of the Obama presidency. Many Americans voted Barack Obama into the White House for that reason alone. That reason is gone. The notion that this president would unify the nation by allowing people to summon their better spirits, as he promised, faded fast. Even Mr. Obama's supporters see now that his operating method wasn't unification, but political and social division. Support for the president among the independents who gave him 52% of their vote in 2008 has fallen into the 30s. Dividing the nation in his first term so that some Americans would vote in anger against his opposition was clearly the game plan from the start. He repeatedly scapegoated the wealthiest and the 1%. In 2012, when House Republicans published their deficit reduction proposals, Mr. Obama dismissed the document as laughable, social Darwinism, and antithetical to our entire history. After 4 years of the politics of divide and conquer, Mr. Obama had stirred sufficient resentment at his political base to win a second term. What he has produced, entering the sixth year of his presidency, is a nation in a state of disunion. The pollsters at Gallup wrote last week that Mr. Obama is on course to have the most politically polarized approval ratings of any president. Segments of the U.S. population see themselves not just in disagreement with the Obama administration, but as the target of its policies. This includes not only the famous 1%, and this is where he really gets into this. It's not only the famous 1%, but also the upper middle class, southern states, charter schools, politically active conservatives, private businesses, the Catholic Church, electric utilities, doctors driven out of Obamacare's health networks, and those famous partisans, the Little Sisters of the Poor. All have been vilified, investigated, audited, or sued by the president himself, Eric Holder's Justice Department, the NLRB, the Securities Exchange Commission, the EPA, and not least the IRS. Last year's most remarkable polling number from Gallup said in December that 72% of Americans regard big government as the greatest threat to the U.S. 72%. They got the message. Even Obamacare has contributed. The law's rules pit the healthy against the unhealthy by forcing them to pay higher premiums to subsidize the unhealthy. I've mentioned that many times, but I've never really considered it exactly that way. He does. He pits one against the other. That's what he does. Catholics, some of whom might have supported Obamacare, see their hospitals as singled out for retribution by their government. The administration supporters dismiss complaints about the in-your-face tenor of the Obama presidency as conservative sour grapes. We won, they say. Get over it. Okay, you won. But what have you done with it? Where's the upside? The slow fade of hope is revealed in last week's Fox News poll, with 74% saying the country feels as if it's still in a recession. No matter that the real one ended in early 2009, 74% think we're still in a recession. It's hard to pretend hope is coming when 5 years after the 2008 election, December's monthly jobs report said 347,000 Americans have given up looking for work. That's your real income inequality. The legions of chronically unemployed Americans who now have no earned income whatsoever. In his speech, Mr. Obama pitched the causes of weak employment back more than three decades. Yes, It's not my fault. This goes back 30 years, which is, by the way, what he always does. The 30-year-old problem has three major policy solutions available to him in 2014. Tax reform, pending free trade legislation, which Harry Reid has shot down, saying he doesn't want to see happen, and immigration reform. All require doing business with the other party in Congress. He can't, and by personal disposition, doesn't want to. The speech made that clear. Instead, Mr. Obama said his overdue promise of change is going to roll in on a cascade of unilateral executive orders and directives from his regulatory bureaucracies. This includes sentencing Joe Biden to reforming all the federal job training programs. Another 30-year failure. Progressives justify coerced. Okay, listen to this paragraph. I don't want to read past this paragraph. He's got this exactly right. Progressives justify coerced public policy with their belief that what they are doing is good. Yes, the ends always justify the means for liberalism, because liberalism in their mind is inherently good. It's like when Bill Maher said that it was okay for President Obama to lie about Obamacare. If you like it, you can keep it, because there was no other way to get it passed, and he had to lie for the greater good. And Obamacare has to be imposed upon people for the greater good. Taxes have to be imposed upon for the greater good. Everything is for the greater good. We're just right. In fact, they don't think they're just right. They think they're righteous. And that's why you should just accept it. So back to Henninger. Progressives justify coerced public policy with their belief that what they're doing is good, setting aside several hundred years of unhappy world history with this notion. Try the French Revolution. A glitch always occurs in the U.S. because the Founding Fathers designed an arduous system for producing progress. The far left has never been able to put its most purebred ideas consistently across the legislative goal line. Too many citizens resist. One might say the same on the far right, but they're not running anything just now. In frustration, and Mr. Obama is nothing if not frustrated, the White House is defaulting, as the left does everywhere, to direct executive action. We're at the dawn of the unilateral presidency. How can this be good if the price is more national disunion than we have now? Disunion is a dangerous political virus that sends a nation as complex as the U.S. toward a state of permanent, embittered opposition, which can be difficult for mere politicians to set right. We're about there. Barack Obama could have allowed for some accommodation to decompress the discord and political tension. For example, he could have lifted the economy with a bipartisan cut in the corporate tax rate in his first term. Instead, he raised taxes on the wealthiest and defined them as people with before-tax incomes above $200,000. Instead, the IRS audited his opponents. Get over it? Not anytime soon. Dan Henninger, today's Wall Street Journal, an absolutely great piece. By the way, I mean, I don't have a lot to add to that, other than even I underestimated how much he does this. He pits party against party in just about everything he does. And I don't mean Democratic Party or Republican Party. I mean, when there are two sides in any given conflict or any given situation. And he's right. Obamacare does pit the healthy against the unhealthy. It's what he does. He is a divider by nature. The Washington Post actually fact-checked his State of the Union. And I don't have a lot of time to go through these. I'll try to do these briefly in a minute. And here's the ones they debunked. The more than 8 million new jobs our businesses have created over the past 4 years. The president is cherry-picking here. It's a number that puts the improvement in the economy in the best possible light. The low point in jobs was reached in February 2010, and there indeed has been a gain of about 8 million since then. Obama saying businesses appears to be referring to private sector growth of 8.2 million. Adding government jobs reduces that to 7.6 million. But the data also show the start of the presidency, about 3.2 million jobs have been created. And the number of jobs in the economy is still about 1.2 million lower than when the recession began. A manufacturing sector that's adding jobs for the first time since the 1990s. Again, the low point was January 10, and there has been a gain of 570,000 jobs since then, But BLS data show the number of manufacturing jobs still a half a million fewer than when he took office. Fewer than when he took office. Our deficits cut by more than half. This was the big one. The federal deficit has declined in half since 2009 from $1.3 trillion to about $600 billion. But that's not much to brag about. The 2009 figure was not just a deficit Obama inherited from his predecessor, since it also reflected the impact of his decisions, such as the $800 billion stimulus enacted early in his term. Moreover, the deficit soared in the first place because of the recession. So as the economy has improved, the deficit naturally decreased. And then they go into others, which I don't have time for. Inequality has deepened. Today, women make up half our workforce, 77 cents on the dollar. It's really closer to 90 cents on the dollar, but there are others. All right, I want to get to one more thing on this. We're going to have quite a bit left on the table for the after-show video today. I have one more thing to get to, and that is the rich guy who said the rich are targeted like Jews were in Nazi Germany. I have a follow-up on that. It's 10:51.
The Jerry Bader Show.